Anyway, so that's it. I'd love to have your comments, questions, feedback, anything. And if anything was, and feel free to say, like, I had no idea what you were talking about when you said that, and I'm happy to go over those too.
Great, thank you so much.
Thanks. Yes?
So the donor advised funds, don't they have to answer to who donated the money?
Well, like the way that, yeah. So what's interesting about them is that they, so what's interesting about them is that there is a difference between the way they operate in terms of how the donor thinks that they operate and the way they operate under the legal rules that govern them. So the way that they work, the reason that they are able to offer all these tax advantages is because the donor, legally, it's the same as if the donor has given money to the Red Cross, right? So if you were to give money to the Red Cross, you give up all legal control over the money. When you give your money to Fidelity Charitable, you give up all legal control over the money. Now, Fidelity Charitable doesn't have $15 billion under management because people, or 20, I think they have 15 now, because people are giving up all legal control and saying, I trust you, Ned Johnson, to spend the money for me, right? They're doing it because they know that Fidelity will, in fact, follow their wishes. And so from the perspective of the person who creates it, it feels like you're setting up a charitable checking account. It has your name on it, you direct how the money is spent, but legally you've given up all your legal rights to it. And they could decide to spend it however they wanted, and that would be within their legal rights. And there was actually a great case where somebody gave money to a donor advised fund called Friends of Fiji and said, I want this money spent on the tsunami victims. And so this was around when it was set up. And gave them $2 million, but instead the creators used it to pay themselves salaries and to have a celebrity golf tournament, and then to defend themselves in the litigation brought by the guy saying, hey, what are you doing with my money? And in court, the court said, no, you gave up all legal control, because that's what a person has to do in order to get the tax benefit. So this is, I think that this is also a bad thing. I've written that this is like a wink and a nod system, that we shouldn't be encouraging tax rules, encouraging people to enter into agreements that don't reflect their wishes. Oh, by the way, the 5% requirement can also be met if cases not covered by salaries and administrative expenses. Contributions to donor advised funds also satisfy the 5% requirement. And you see this a lot with private foundations just giving the money to the staff, because for all purposes, the charities that are set up are public charities, just like the Red Cross. Alan?
Your question is probably more important than mine.
No, definitely not.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
The first, so regarding donor advised funds, is there a payout tie? Is there like a fixed number of years where they must pay out by?
No.
Okay, so if I give $5 million to a donor advised fund, it is the donor advised fund's obligation to eventually pay $5 million to a charity?
No, because the donor advised fund is itself a charity. So all charitable acts have been completed when the money goes to Fidelity Charitable and it owns the money. It's the same as if you gave $5 million to the Red Cross. They're not obligated to do anything in particular with it because they meet the definition of what we call a public charity. And so we sort of trust that they're going to act charitably with it.
Okay. So I guess my question is then, there might be an even greater like inefficiency baked into that structure, because if I give $5 million but it's not maybe distributed ultimately to a charity until several years later, then because a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow, or a dollar tomorrow is worth
right.
more.
Now this money though will be, they'll invest the money.
Okay.
And so presumably it will grow, right? And so when it's spent tomorrow, there should be like $1.50 in there.
Sure.
Right? So they say, the proponents of donor advised funds say, what's the problem? As long as the money's not going to anywhere other than charity, the time shouldn't matter whether it's spent today, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, or 500 years from now. And so so that's what people who think that there shouldn't be a payout requirement.
Okay, I was just curious, because if they're able to claim the benefits immediately.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if time value of money factored into
right. So that's a big question about how does time value of money come into play with these things. But I think generally, because the growth is also committed to charity, you don't have a time value of money
okay.
problem.
And then, thank you. And then yeah. my second question is, in the example used of the $10 million,
yeah.
is it does that suggest that the case where the tax deductions that a company receives any time that figure is larger than the ultimate, than that 2.4. So anytime the 7.6 is larger than a 2.4, is that a net loss to the public good? What is it like? What does that suggest?
Well, it just says, I mean, well, think about it this way. Somebody gives $10 million to the Red Cross, right? And
sure.
They save $7.6 million in taxes. So I wouldn't say it's necessarily a net loss to the public good as long as you think the Red Cross is doing good work. Some people say, so Saul Levmore, who's a political, for those who are interested in like political theory things, he thinks that this charitable system works well because it's a little bit of a way that it's like voting with your dollars. You're saying, I think the government should support the Red Cross, and I'm showing it because I give my money there, and therefore the government should give their money there. The problem comes about where we have the whose dollars are being matched, and the people that are being best matched are the wealthiest, as opposed to people that are get people, for example, who don't itemize, don't get any tax benefits of charitable contributions.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So I'm thinking about what's called the perpetuity model.
Yeah.
And a couple of right-wing foundations became well-known for having an anti-perpetuity.
Yeah.
The John M. Olin and the Earhart Foundation, that
right.
They explicitly go out of business.
Yeah.
After a certain amount of time. They are, by the way, big funders of the political science department at Boston College.
Yeah.
What about that? Is that likely to catch on? I know that was strictly a reaction to what they called the liberal Ford
yeah.
Foundation.
Yeah.
So, but has there been any movement?
Well, so that's what, right, and that's what's going on now. So like Atlantic Philanthropies, they're not a right wing, but they were very much in favor of this sort of more, the kind of giving while living model,
mm-hmm.
making it, and so there's a lot of arguments in favor of the giving while living model. One of them is that you're concerned, for the conservatives, they're concerned that there is a shift away from mission, right?
Mm-hmm.
Only that person can decide, and they point to the Ford Foundation, and they're like, look at Ford. He was a real bastard. And now, look at the way they're running it now. They're trying to promote all these equality and anti-poverty, and Ford would be running over and, you know, rolling over in his grave if he ever saw that. He would want to be.
He was their other big example.
And right. And so, like, these people. So one of these things, that's just sort of an interesting idea about what it means to protect people's visions in perpetuity. That sort of goes back to that other, the earlier question. So as a matter of efficacy, a lot of donors are doing it for that reason. Some argue that as a matter of morality, and so some of the people we're having are actually moral philosophers who are coming to our conference, that as a matter of morality, people should be spending more currently because we have, you know, we're in a time of crisis, and what does it mean? You know, you can sort of imagine the world ending due to any number of the problems that we currently have, and then we'll have all this money set aside in perpetuity to address, you know, climate change or whatever it is. And so you have arguments coming at it from that side. So there's a lot of ways that people can come to this question of perpetuities, but one of them is this idea of you do have conservatives saying, like, I got to be spending my money now so I know it's spent how I want it to be spent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
So two questions. One is, do you have any positive examples that you're drawing on to provide a reference point for how these types of arrangements are being used for the public good? Okay, so that's my first
yeah.
question. My second is whether there are, what's the religion piece in this? Are there religious advised foundations that are, or managed funds that are having particular directives in the public good?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the public good is always being served where organizations are working for important missions and they're spending their money efficiently and they're working well towards them. So I'm not anti the charitable sector. You know, I think that there's lots of ways in which people can do things individually in ways better than how government can do it. They see a local problem, they solve it locally, they have a smart idea about it. So,
But are you drawing on particular examples? I'm just trying to pin you down to particular, because one of the ways to develop the work would be showing when it's done right and uncynically, then.
No, I guess because I think that the good examples are kind of obvious to the public. I think we all sort of think Red Cross, I think the Greater Boston Food Bank does a great job. I mean, I think lots of organizations do a great job in solving problems well, and they do it without the bureaucracy of government. And so I think...
But I'm thinking of your two categories, the private...
Oh, in terms of funders?
Donor advised funds, for example.
I'm sure plenty of people contribute
to... Is anyone auditing these things?
What's that?
Is anyone auditing where the
money No, because the rules are... they're not violating the rules, right? This is the rules say what you should be doing. So I guess I don't think of it in terms of good or bad. Maybe I'm not understanding your question, but I think that there's plenty of, you could take any number of organizations, right? You could take, let's say, the Ford Foundation, right? They're sort of now committed to addressing inequality and things like that. There are people that say, isn't it better that Ford's money was set aside in perpetuity and now every generation can decide how the money's going to be spent? You know, that type of thing, and that's a good thing. You'd have to kind of believe in the mission, and you'd have to, I don't know, because I guess I can't figure out how to answer your question. I don't. Because I don't, I'm more interested in, I have so much of a tax head about this.
Right.
I can only think about, okay, this is what the tax rules allow. Sure, it can allow some good things, but it has all of these problematic things, and we're not doing enough to address the problematic things. And I guess I take the good things for granted.
Okay.
In terms of religious, one of the things that you have in terms of the rise of DAFs is they were very big in the Jewish Federation and in and now Catholic Charities has them, and again, they have these two features, which is that they allow these organizations to connect with donors, right? Give your money to us, we can hold it for you, we can give you all the same tax advantages that you get if you give to a real charity, but you can also get ongoing control for as long as you like. And I know the Jewish Federation in particular is very much driven by DAFs and their fees that they're getting from running their DAFs. So you see that this happening all over. And I think the way I see it is that there's been a little bit of a race to the bottom as all these mission-driven organizations that previously connected with donors as a way to get people to give to their community now have to offer the donors all of the freedom that they would have at a Fidelity or Schwab or a Vanguard. And so where people give to these institutions, they have to have the ability to distribute it anywhere out because otherwise people won't give to them. So, yes.
Why is that legal that they can retain control of the money even though they've given it away to a charity and gotten the deduction?
Because they don't have legal control. They only have de facto control. It's donor advised funds, not donor controlled funds.
So that's...
So legally, Fidelity doesn't have to follow any instructions, nor does Catholic Charities, Jewish Philanthropies, Boston Foundation. They can say, sorry, we're going to use this money to pay ourselves salaries and have a celebrity golf tournament.
And that's enough for someone with $10 million to do that instead of give to a charity of their choice?
Yeah, because it gives them ongoing control. And they know that these organizations are not going to benefit. Fidelity doesn't need to spend your money how they want. They've got plenty of money just having it under management. So it operates outside of the law because these institutions are so large. Nobody who gives to the Boston Foundation who gives $10 million to the Boston Foundation thinks, oh, Paul Grogan's going to steal my money. You know, they'll figure, they just trust these institutions. And usually, rightfully so, although not always. Yes?
So this is like, it's sort of a form of tax evasion for a lot of these, and you would think if the government trying to control their level of tax revenues, there'd be a limit to donations every year. Has there been an overall drop in the tax income to the government because of these charities? And of course, examples like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Facebook here giving away $50 billion, $100 billion, which is the money's never really taxed, and now the money's given away, so the country
it's still not taxed.
It's still not taxed. What's the long-term thoughts about the level of taxation in the country,
well,
effective
I,
taxation.
I think that the problems are that the with our tax system, generally speaking, is that, like, when you look at the Zuckerberg case, right? So Mark Zuckerberg, I don't know if you saw, they gave that big gift, but it turns out they didn't really give it to charity. And what I think is interesting is how somebody with $45 billion worth of assets doesn't have to worry about taxes in our current system. And that's because we already are so favorable towards the wealthy under our tax system that we don't have, for example, an annual wealth tax. So somebody who happens to have $45 billion doesn't have to worry about taxes.
Some states do.
What's that?
Some states do. Like Florida, I think.
Okay, so maybe some states do, but from a federal basis, wealthy people already don't have to worry about taxes. So we have so many bigger problems there than the problems from the charitable giving. And I guess, so what I'm interested when I look at the problems of the charitable giving is whether we're actually getting what we're getting for our charitable investment, as opposed to that it's an overall. I'm less concerned with the fact that money's not going to the government and more concerned that it's not going to charities. Yes?
So in this term, public-private partnership, it seems like the roles of the partners are extremely different and unequal when it comes to allocation. And I wonder, do you see a way that the partnership might be improved on the public good side?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of the information that you've given us has to do with the definitions of philanthropy and the expansion to allow the entry of non-charitable entities. But what about the public good? Who defines that?
Yeah.
And who directs? Is there a partner who directs the private sector toward that?
So the way that we define it is because we say you only get these benefits if you give to a 501c3 organization. And so a 501c3 organization, we define this country very broadly as being any organization committed to charitable purpose in its broadest ways and in which there's no private enrollment.
Is BC a 501c3?
Yeah. Any college, university, unless people are taking out profits, they can be anybody. It's pretty much anybody can be a nonprofit. Now, there's an interesting question as a society about how broad or narrow you want to have it. And one of the projects that we're actually doing is we're in conversation with Salzburg Global Seminars about convening an international group, because whenever you have tax-subsidized charitable giving, you raise these questions about how broad or narrow do you want your definition of charity to be, as well as other questions, right? Where do you want to give the subsidy? One of the ways it's come up in the United States is that we have a very small amount of money that goes to the poor in terms of under our charitable system. And so some have considered whether we should be having additional tax benefits if people actually give money committed to the poor as opposed to not. And that would be a way that would be in response to your concern. And I think part of the problems is that when you actually start defining these things, it's very hard to do it in a way that's going to give the results that you want. And so I think that's been the resistance to it. But you do see people occasionally arguing for it. Yes?
So do you have any idea what percentage of these European countries that fund from the government, what percentage of taxes they pay? If our highest is like 39%, then...
Oh, I don't know. But our taxes, by the way, are historically tremendously low for the history of this country, too. Like, so, you know, in the 60s, they were income tax rates were like 85%, even 90%. And when Reagan took office, he brought it down to 50%. So we are, our tax rates are very low historically. But the other thing is that a lot of European countries have VATs, value-added taxes, that are a form of a sales tax. And so that's a different way. They don't rely on income taxes as much as we do.
How would a Bernie administration look at this, and what would be on his mind to try and make some changes?
You know, I've actually been in conversation with the with his tax guy because the Bernie administration is actually about. They had a proposal, and I don't know whether or not they were going to do it or not, to have an annual wealth tax. Which would at least, impose taxes on, to try to get the wealthy to pay taxes other than by income taxes. But the other thing is, in terms of the payout here of DAFs, just one other thing to mention. So I had written an op-ed a couple of years ago that said that DAFs should have to be paid out within 10 years or something like that. And that was fun. I got some letters, but it didn't go anywhere. But the reason everybody hates me was because what happened a couple of years ago was that Congressman Camp came out with a tax bill, and in his tax bill he said all DAF should be paid out within 5 years. And so this was like a real, you can imagine what this did to unify Fidelity Schwab, Boston Foundation, all these people. And so because I had written an op-ed that had suggested payout requirement, they kind of were looking at me as the person that which it wasn't me. I don't think it takes somebody, this is a fairly obvious point that if you're gonna give all the tax advantages, you should require some payout requirement. But there's been a kind of an interesting discourse about it because proponents of DAFs are so in their worldview that they cannot believe that anybody thinks that it's a problem. They just think that this is just the growth of charitable dollars and this is all good. Why would anybody think this was a problem? And they'll often be like, well, the problem is you, me, and Al Cantor, who's another guy who writes about this, and like all the rest of the world thinks this is totally fine, and it's like, why can't the two of you get with the program? And it's like, this has nothing to do with me. It's because people think this is a problem, and nonprofits think it's a problem. If you speak to people who run nonprofits, they are concerned about money being stuck in private foundations and DAFs and not flowing to the charitable organizations that we think of when we think about why we have benefits for the charitable giving. Yes?
So the material benefits of these, of this type of philanthropy are clear enough, you know, lower taxes and more control over a certain wealth. I wonder, what about the ideology behind it? Are there attempts to sort of like defund government?
I mean, I think what's interesting is that all these issues about things like payout from private foundations and donor advised funds are actually pushed by Republicans, because Republicans are interested in the growth of charity is about a smaller government and more being done by the private sector. So that's a very much of a Republican value. And so this issue about payouts and things like that actually come from people like Grassley and Camp. So there's lots of interesting ways of thinking about this, about the allocation between what the public does and what the private does. On the other side, I think what you see when you look internationally is there's a real problem too, because one of the benefits of our system is it has this sort of this growth of civil society and people engaging in lots of ways over lots of issues, and you don't want so much of a government top-down system saying what's going to count and what isn't going to count. And so the questions are kind of complex, I think, about there's not an easy answer about how broad you want it to be or how narrow you want it to be, because I think each has its problems.
The previous presidential campaign, Mitt Romney, had the reputation of being quite philanthropic, but all his money went to Mormon charities, which then only give money to Mormons. So is there any of that going on, of people wanting to restrict, like Republicans, for example, wanting to restrict just to Christian churches or just to evangelical?
No, I think what they do is they allow, what our current system does is it freely allows everybody to decide for themselves what their vision of good is, and they can do that. And I think that's the thing that's touted as being a strength of our system, but you're going to always be supporting things that people think of maybe aren't so great, you know? I mean, like, whether it's the NRA or the ACLU, you're going to have their charitable arm that's going to be able to receive charitable benefits. So, and this diversity is, as they say...
Are there any limit? I mean, you're a law professor, so can you push a hypothetical to a point where something wouldn't be allowed, charitably speaking, giving to the American Association of Cannibalism?
It would have to be that. Really, I mean, you're very hard-pressed to find things that are not charitable. Now, it's interesting, in the early days, it was much more, what's that?
It's Islamic State.
Yes, that's right. You can't fund terrorism. That's been the one. And actually, there have been some cases where people do, you know, where people make charitable donations to mosques that have seemed to be affiliated with, and that's a real, that is something that's not allowed. But what's interesting, though, is when you think about the other side, there were early cases. Remember, there was that whole period, 19th century, very anti, and somebody set up their trust, and it was to, it was a Massachusetts case, and one of it was to be in support of women's right to vote. And that was found to be not philanthropic because you are pushing for the overthrow of rules in the government. Like that was like that's clearly bad, you know. So you know it's hard because you have these examples that you think, oh, this is like a bad example, but then you start thinking about what a rule is going to look like, and often the rule ends up being worse than the problem you're trying to solve. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. When people talk about market solutions to social problems and the the efficiency of the market being brought to bear on these, it sounds like they're what I've always thought about is market application of money and elimination of excess waste and so on. But it seems like there's also an attempt to use the market to define the good, like put these competing definitions of what's good in play and see which one wins. Is that?
So what are you, you're talking about the market of philanthropy?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I mean, everyone here at this table can decide how we want to allocate government resources by making private contributions to all those charities that send us notifications in December. So, I mean, there is that way, there is a market of, there is a philanthropic market.
It's a competitive market.
Yeah, no, very competitive market. And that's why, I mean, one of the interesting things I think about the rise of DAFs is that I think people have information overload. They can't really, they feel like they want to be charitable for whatever reason, but they don't know how best to spend their money. And then you read about like, oh, and look what the Cancer Society did or the Red Cross did, and they're afraid of spending their money unwisely. And so the DAFs kind of feed into that because it says, look, you can make a charitable donation, you can feel good about it, you can get your tax benefits, but you can decide later on how to spend it. And what I'm concerned about is that inertia can set in as well as a sense of identity with that money, and it makes it harder for the money to come out. I think that our current rules, they can inadvertently result in money continuing to grow rather than being spent because people don't know how to spend wisely and they are stymied about it. Yeah.
So this may be moving away slightly, but I don't have $10 million to give.
Yes.
Right. So as someone that has a modest salary, what should we be doing with our charitable contributions? Do you have any advice for us?
No, I mean, I think it's the same. Look for the same thing myself. I think it's should look for organizations that are doing things you believe in, and you should see, ideally, you should spend the time to see whether the people that are running it are doing a good job at it. It's very hard to tell.
Yeah.
As I say, I mean, I've gotten involved with the Greater Boston Food Bank because I wanted to sort of think about, well, where's a place that's just like pretty much plain vanilla good? I mean, so that's an organization we have Father Fred Edmund. He builds houses in Worcester. I think local organizations that are doing things, people that are doing them. That's a great way to spend your money. But other people believe in supporting institutions. I mean, one of the programs we're going to have next year, don't tell Father Leahy, is on university endowments. Because university endowments get a significant subsidy when we allow them to grow tax-free. And Henry Hansman at Yale wrote a really interesting article about, like, why do we allow these tax-free growth of university endowments? And when he wrote it, he was like, look at this, Harvard University is $4 billion, and this is crazy, it's so big. Well, today, he wrote this, 12 years ago, and today, $36 billion, yeah. It's these things, and is there a time when we should stop allowing the tax-free growth? And actually, Congress was holding hearings on it this year about whether this is, because there's a lot of interest. What Henry Hansman discovered, or wrote about at least, is that one of the reasons he thought you have these growing endowments is because the endowments are controlled by money managers, and money managers view themselves as their value is to grow money and not to, so even though they are trustees of a university and it's supposed to be about promoting the university mission, it often gets conflated with promoting the growth of wealth. And the growth of wealth is not the same as spending money.
Well, and I guess part of my question, which I didn't articulate well, is on the tax front. I never itemize my taxes. So
get no tax benefits.
Right. But I wonder now if as a responsible citizen, I should itemize my charitable. I mean, maybe I should itemize everything, but is it beneficial to society if I go through the process of itemizing my...
No, it's only beneficial to you because you get your... because then you get a lower taxes if you have enough to itemize.
Okay.
But you will not, but you'll have to be taxed at the highest rate. You'll have to get more salary, Alan, in order to really get the
Do
most.
I can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
No, I mean, but the food bank's a good example. I mean, the food bank started out as a mechanism to fill the gaps between
right.
what government provided in their safety net programs in the 70s and then the cuts that took place. Well, the 70s, there were already gaps, and then with Reagan's cuts, there were
yeah.
many, many more cuts in that safety net. But then they started, but they were supposed to end hunger. That was the mission,
yeah.
except then they started to collect endowments.
And so this is, yes. And this is
so this is very interesting. So this is very interesting, and there's kind of a, there was a very sharp critical literature about that. Like, if your mission is to end hunger, are you then saying, well, hunger's here in perpetuity, so we're setting up these endowment funds in perpetuity?
So that, I would be so interested in seeing that, because that's exactly, I think, the types of questions that we should be asking ourselves.
It's out there. I can give you some.
That would be great. Yeah. And it's interesting because I see it with the Hewlett Foundation. They're like trying, they're giving this rallying cry. Everybody should be giving money to climate change. This is the crisis of our day. But it's like you can't get them to spend more than 5% of their money. They will not do it because, you know, so, and there are, and the reason is because you do get other interests at play when you have big piles of money. Other personal interests of control, you know, what somebody gets. And if someone's the head of a $10 billion foundation, you know, that's just better than being the head of a $2 billion foundation. So I'm concerned about those things that come into play. Yeah?
This is sort of an example of the problem of tax policy in this country. Republicans have blocked taxes on many, many things. One example is gasoline tax. I mean, the last gasoline tax went through was under Clinton. I think gasoline tax is 18.5 cents a gallon, and probably it should be a dollar a gallon. So now the Highway Trust Fund is bankrupt. The Federal Highway Trust Fund is bankrupt. So now Obama, out of frustration the other day, announced he wants to put through a $10 tax on a barrel of oil, which sounds outrageous when you consider oil's at $30 a barrel, so $10
yeah.
is a third of the value.
Yeah.
But if you would have said, that we're going to try and put the Highway Trust Fund at 25 cent tax on gasoline per gallon, which is the same as $10 a barrel. But now the tax policy in this country is a mess.
Yeah.
And the Republicans sort of have the logical tax policy blocked here, and this is another avenue of sort of tax evasion.
Right. It's, although I don't know what happens when you called it allowed tax evasion. So.
Yeah,
illegal tax evasion.
Legal tax evasion.
Yeah.
So it's another example. I think the federal ability to manage the government is becoming more and more difficult.
Yeah.
So the only way they can manage it is to run the deficit.
Right.
The only thing left is, as you said, if we put a wealth tax through, I don't know what the wealth of this country is, but it's pretty large. So if you put a wealth tax, I mean, we pay real estate tax, which in a sense is a wealth
yeah.
tax. If you put a wealth tax through of 10%, 15%, you could balance a budget like that. So I think sooner or later, something like
that. Yeah, well, they're talking about like an annual, so the
Bernie
proposal would be an annual tax of 1%. Because you want it to be small enough that it's...
Well, let's say the income tax. You start with one, of course. Where does it go? We don't know.
Yeah. Right. So, all right. Well, thank you so much, everybody. And if anyone has, I'm happy to stick around.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's lots of food left. Please help yourself.